This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
I'll never get over how TV shows make court cases look so succinct. I mean, we all know it isn't true. CSI wraps up an investigation in an hour, and we know that's absurd. And it's okay because it's just television. If a show chronicled the process realistically, we'd be watching for weeks on end. I mean, more even. Months. Years. No one has time for that. It would be ridiculous. Of course, in real life, these cases do take weeks and months and years, and the people involved feel like they don't have time for it either. They've got lives they want to live. We only get one of those, after all. And yet, once you're enmeshed in the legal system, there's no shortcut, no editing process that makes it more manageable. For people accused of heinous crimes, it becomes their lives, years of their lives. Decades sometimes, even if they're innocent. A lot of people don't think Elwood Jones is innocent, but a lot of people do. As it stands right now, he is not convicted of the murder with which he's been accused. Jones's case began in September 1994 when Rhoda Nathan, a beloved New Jersey woman, died in the Ohio hotel where Jones worked. That's 30 years ago now. 30 and change. For most of those three intervening decades, Jones was in prison on death row. I know this story well because I told Elwood's story in depth throughout a full season of a podcast called Accused. I intended to update Elwood's story in that podcast feed, but the company I worked for when I created that show defunded the work I was doing. Journalism's kind of in a crisis state after all. And kept ownership of the podcast when I quit over it, so I'm here, starting anew. If you found this new feed and don't yet know Elwood's story, it might feel like we're starting a tale mid-sentence, but even if you did listen to that whole season of Accused, chances are you could use a reminder on a few things, so let's start there. Jones, then 42 years old, worked at the Embassy Suites Hotel in 1994 and was there the morning Nathan was killed in her hotel room. Rhoda, age 67, had been in town for her best friend's grandson's bar mitzvah. She and the best friend, Elaine Shub, shared a hotel room with Shub's partner. Well, boyfriend, but that always sounds weird to say in the context of an elderly couple. Rhoda and Elaine shared the suite's main bed while Shub's partner, Joe Kaplan, slept on a pull-out couch in the living room portion of the suite. The morning of September 3, 1994, Joe and Elaine had gone to breakfast, while Rhoda stayed in the hotel room. She took a shower and apparently interrupted someone robbing the room when she stepped out of the bathroom, wearing only a towel. When Elaine and Joe returned to the room, they had Elaine's daughter and grandson in tow. The quartet opened the door to the hotel room and discovered Rhoda beaten and bruised and barely breathing on the floor. Medics would fight to save her to no avail. Shub's daughter, Cynthia Kirsch, told me her son, only 6 years old at the time, was forever traumatized by the experience. In fairness, so were Cynthia and her mother. Elaine let out a blood-curdling scream at the sight of her best friend, and that scream seemed to bifurcate her life. She was never the same afterward. Police and prosecutors zeroed in on Elwood Jones as the killer because he sustained a hand wound the same day Rhoda died. He had a nasty infection in his dominant hand that law enforcement theorized came from punching Rhoda in the mouth. This evidence sounded so convincing that Forensic Files did an episode on Elwood's conviction, touting it as a win for forensic science.
An alert doctor noticed a horrible infection on the finger of a hotel worker who had come to the emergency room for treatment of his injury. The virulence of that infection was a clue to the mystery.
It sounds pretty good, right? At trial, the prosecution presented a hand surgeon, John McDonough, who said the few times he had ever seen infections like Elwood's was when he treated so-called fight bite injuries. In short, the expert said that a specific bacteria, Eichenella corridens, is mostly found in people's mouths, and when someone punches another person in the mouth so hard that a tooth cuts the puncher's hand, it can cause a gnarly infection teeming with that bacteria. McDonough said he was certain Elwood's infection could only have come from punching someone in the mouth. Elwood, meanwhile, said he didn't punch anyone, that he cut himself falling on metal steps leading to a dumpster. Police's response? Yeah, likely story. Fast forward to 2022, and Elwood's pro bono lawyers presented an expert in microbiology who said McDonough's original trial testimony was inaccurate. Dr. Stephen Burdett said he had seen Eichenella corridens, quote, literally from the foot all the way up to the brain, end quote. McDonough wasn't able to testify at that August 2022 hearing because he died in 2019. The University of Cincinnati College of Medicine has named its foyer after him. That same hearing also laid out details about how prosecutors failed to turn over nearly 4,000 pages of investigatory documents to Jones's original defense team. It all worked together to convince Hamilton County Municipal Judge Wendy Cross that justice had not been served in the case. 4 months later, Cross ordered a new trial and, about a month after that, released Jones from prison to await it. Jones walked out of prison with a smile on his face on January 14th, 2023. The system had taken an awfully long time to work, but work it had. At least in Elwood's view, prosecutors thought otherwise. They said the judge had overreached, releasing a heartless killer back into society. Prosecutor Joe Dieters even took the unusual step of producing a slick video about it. It actually came out before Cross even made a ruling, leading some to speculate he was trying to sway her decision.
We don't need some murderous bastard like Elwood Jones walking around our community. I mean, anybody do this to an old lady, he'd kill your mom. He'd kill anybody's mom.
Judge Cross didn't see things that way, and despite prosecutors' attempts to make her reconsider her decision, she's stood firm. So prosecutors have appealed to other courts on a variety of issues, and one of those issues finally reached the state's highest court, the Ohio Supreme Court.
In our final case today, 2023-0772, in the matter of the state of Ohio versus Elwood Jones.
That was February 13th of this year, 2025. It's been 30 years since Rhoda died, 27 years since Elwood was convicted, and 6 years since I first started reporting on his case. The last time I updated podcast listeners on his status, in any feed, was 2 years ago. Some stuff has happened since then, and some more stuff is expected to happen very soon. Welcome to What If They're Wrong? After the accusation. When I last talked about the case against Elwood Jones, he was out of prison and Joe Dieters was out of Hamilton County. Well, Dieters still lives here, as far as I know, but he doesn't work here anymore. He works for the Ohio Supreme Court. He was appointed to fill a vacancy that wasn't set to expire until 2026. He could have run for re-election to that seat when it expired, but instead, he opted to run in 2024 against a Democrat seeking re-election, so a fellow justice, a colleague of his on the bench. It was a strategic move to solidify GOP power in the state, and it worked. There's now one Democrat left on the 7-seat Ohio Supreme Court. You might be cringing at me talking politics in a true crime podcast, but here's the thing about that. There's no avoiding politics. Prosecutors, after all, are elected officials, and everything's political. That's as true everywhere as it is in Hamilton County, where Dieters had been succeeded in his post as top prosecutor by one of his proteges, a woman named Melissa Powers. She tried to keep her appointed seat in 2024, but she was ousted by a Democrat named Connie Pillage. This was a big deal in Hamilton County, as Local 12 reported.
And it's important to note that for the first time in 92 years in Hamilton County, a Democrat has won that prosecutor's position. Reporting live, Annie Brown, Local 12 News.
92 years. Even in political strongholds, that's a mighty long time without interruption. If you're not from Ohio, you probably think of the whole state as a Republican stronghold, but that's not actually true. The big cities, Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati, lean blue, like a lot of metropolitan areas in this country. The outcome of 2024's election made it clear that Hamilton County has, in recent years, become super-duper blue. There's just one elected Republican official in a non-judicial post left here, and that's the county engineer, who basically has no opposition. But for years, even while the rest of the county was mostly blue, the prosecutor's office stayed firmly red, with Joe Dieters helming it for about a quarter century, from 1992 to 1999, and again from 2005 to 2023. Even when he took that 6-year hiatus, the post still went to a Republican. Part of that is because a lot of people feel Republicans are tougher on crime and criminals. NBC News did a poll on this in 2023 that showed 46% of Americans think Republicans are better at dealing with crime. Just 20% said Democrats are. Now, Pillage was a change candidate. She campaigned on the idea that Melissa Powers, a Republican hired by Dieters, would be more of the same. Pillage's platform was reform. Every time I wrote a story for the Cincinnati Inquirer, even remotely critical of the prosecutor's office, Pillage's campaign emailed it out, looking to drum up votes. And in all transparency, I wrote a few such stories. In 2024, my colleague Dan Horn and I uncovered some shadiness in past prosecutions that we published in a series of investigations. You'll hear more about those cases later, as in next season. But for now, what's important to know is that in Hamilton County, with the ousting of Powers, there was a changing of the guard, and Elwood Jones and his lawyers were here for it. I asked Jones about it last November, just after the election.
Were you paying attention to the prosecutor's race?
No, not really closely. At the end, I looked and I went to sleep, to be honest. I was hoping that she'd win, and when I woke up, I had a text from Dave Jones Elwood, Connie Phelps won.
The Dave he's referring to is lawyer David Hine. Of course Elwood wanted Pillage to win. Melissa Powers had been parroting what her predecessor, Joe Dieters, had said about him, that he was a killer who would kill again, that the judge who overturned the verdict was a zealot. Powers made it clear she had no interest in re-examining Jones's case on the merits and continued to send the same assistant prosecutors after him, insisting that he should be sent back to death row or at least retried for murder. So, yeah, it's no surprise Elwood favored the newcomer over the person who was actively trying to reconvict him. That's a no-brainer. But that didn't mean he trusted Pillage would re-examine his case either. It just meant he hoped she would, and there was a higher probability that she would than Powers would, because Powers' probability was at zero. That hasn't happened, though. After the election, Elwood's lawyers, Jay Clark and David Hine, hoped they would get a meeting with Pillage. Here's Hine explaining.
So a number of people reached out on Elwood's behalf. We reached out directly, and she reached out and said, I'd love to talk to you. Let's pick a time.
It was a noisy room, so if you couldn't hear him, he said she was supposed to reach back out with her schedule so they could set up a meeting. That hasn't happened yet. What has happened is that Hine and Clark appeared before the Supreme Court, the same Supreme Court on which Dieters now sits, to argue on Elwood's behalf.
I would like to thank Judge Tucker of the Second District Court of Appeals for agreeing to sit today for Justice Dieters. Judge, thank you for being here.
The oral arguments at the Ohio Supreme Court building in Columbus took place 6 days after my last day as a Cincinnati Inquirer reporter, where I'd worked for 10 years. In all that time, much of it spent covering criminal cases, I'd never been to this building. I'd covered Obergefell, that's the landmark same-sex marriage case at the U.S. Supreme Court back in 2014, but nothing here at the state level. Let me set the scene, because the courtroom is unbelievable. It's stately. Murals cover the ceiling. Damask tapestries drape the walls. Everywhere you look is walnut and marble. The room has a theme, and that theme is history. The ceiling is divided into 5 sections, each representing a state carved from the Northwest Territory. The bench itself features carvings that represent, and I'm quoting from the court's website here, significant developments or elements of Ohio law. In Latin, beneath the clock is the phrase, while I speak, time flies. That feels so surreal in this room, where it feels like time stands still. Which brings me back to Elwood, for whom time is standing still. You might think that after spending all of those years in prison, on death row no less, with nothing happening in his case year after year, he would have been primed for stasis after his release. But he told me he wasn't.
Now, when you were released in 23, how long did you think the limbo would be after that? Like, when did you think you would have a new trial?
I thought it would move forward just the way it was scheduled. And then when the appeals court, how they ruled that in favor to dismiss and everything, that it just began to be a ball that every time something was dismissed, it was, well, we appeal this.
The retrial was initially supposed to happen in February 2024, but he's right. It's been one appeal after another ever since. This is the part the court procedurals on TV really get wrong. Usually in a TV show, someone's convicted and the episode ends. In rare instances where an appeal is even depicted, it's an appeal on the merits of the case. It's about whether the convicted was truly innocent or not. But in the real world, once someone's convicted, odds are enormous that they're going to stay convicted, even if they're innocent. The only exceptions to that, generally speaking, are when there's a technical issue in how the case was investigated or prosecuted, or if new evidence surfaces that wasn't available at the time of the trial. After Elwood's conviction, he appealed on every ground his lawyers could conjure, and he lost every single time. Some of those appeals had to do with the documents that police and prosecutors withheld from his original defense lawyers. Things like questionnaires that had been sent to hotel guests who said they had spotted suspicious people in and around the hotel the morning Rhoda Nathan was killed. And statements from several employees who said a number of master keys to the hotel were missing and unaccounted for. Now, these were all matters raised in that August 2022 hearing, but they had been raised previously, too, as Dieters himself once explained to Cincinnati radio host Bill Cunningham.
The liberals love to talk, oh, the federal courts are so great. The federal courts here, okay, in the Sixth Circuit, on the district level and in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, they looked at these exact issues that Cross ruled on today and said they had no merit. if your listeners take anything away from this, these issues aren't new. These issues were litigated in federal court.
He's right. The courts prior to that 2022 hearing had heard about most of the withheld information and decided that it likely wouldn't have mattered to the jury, that the jury probably would have still found Elwood guilty anyway. And so the conviction stood. But it's worth noting, too, that the 2022 hearing was the first time any judge was presented with all of those documents at once, plus new information that a woman had called police back in 1995, so after the murder but before Elwood's trial, saying that another woman, Linda Reed, told her that her husband had actually killed Rhoda. Now, the allegation seems far-fetched, and Assistant Prosecutor Philip Cummings dismisses it as
double hearsay.
But here's the thing. Linda Reed's husband, Earl Reed, generally matched the description of a guy other witnesses had said they'd seen around Rhoda's hotel room when she died. One woman described a tall, lanky white man hustling away from the hotel through a side door that had been propped open by a plastic cup. Not only that, but the guy was headed on foot in the direction of Earl Reed's house. He lived only a mile or so from the hotel. A staffer separately said he saw a tall, lanky white man with a black man outside of Rhoda's actual hotel room, and that the men had walkie-talkies, which on the surface might not seem like much, but Rhoda was beaten with an object that left rectangular bruises on her chest. This witness who called police in 95 about Earl Reed's possible confession was named Dolores Suggs, and at the August 2022 hearing, she testified not just about calling with this information, but also about seeing a wrongful conviction case covered decades later on a TV show, which triggered a memory about this case. In a middle-of-the-night panic, she woke up her then-adult daughter saying, "Hey, this one time I had information about a guy who said he killed a woman in a hotel and framed a black guy for doing it." After that, Dolores' daughter Googled the case, saw that the suspect in it was Elwood Jones, and that Elwood was on death row for the murder. She reached out to Elwood through the prison email system, and that's how Elwood's new lawyers knew to have both Dolores and her daughter testify in 2022. The police say there was no record of Dolores' phone call, but as Judge Cross noted, police kept terrible records, so the lack of that record doesn't mean much. I mean, there was a tip line asking people for information about the murder, yet there was no logbook for the calls that came in. So would a jury back in the late 90s have reached a different verdict if they'd known about the nearly 4,000 withheld documents plus this alternate suspect? Cross said maybe, because some of the information that seemed unimportant the first time it was raised, like a random white guy walking away from a hotel room, might have taken on increased importance in the minds of jurors if they had also known about Earl Reed's supposed confession. Cross decided that all of that information together might have swayed the jury the other direction, and so she granted Jones a new trial. That fell under the category of a Brady violation, which refers to when police and/or prosecutors fail to turn over potentially exculpatory evidence to the defense before trial. But the documents weren't the only reason she provided. Her ruling, which was 18 pages long, also cited PETRO. That's P-E-T-R-O, and it's lawyer shorthand for referencing State versus PETRO, a case that led to the Ohio Supreme Court establishing the test for when newly discovered evidence should lead to a new trial. The Brady stuff largely wasn't new. The PETRO stuff was new. Some of it had to do with Rhoda Nathan having had an active hepatitis B infection, which the defense found interesting, because their experts say that if Elwood had punched Rhoda so hard his hand got infected from her mouth bacteria, then surely he would have contracted the highly contagious hepatitis B infection too, yet he's never tested positive for the virus, not even 30 years later. There was also new science. Elwood's team brought in Dr. Stephen Burdett, the expert mentioned earlier, who testified that the surgeon who treated Elwood's infection got key facts wrong. like insisting the only way Elwood could have contracted Eikenella choroidins was by punching someone. Not true, Burdett said. Elwood told doctors he licked the wound, which could explain the infection. And anyway, Burdett said, the infection wasn't even primarily caused by Eikenella. Here he is in that hearing, being questioned by David Hine.
Putting the mouth to a wound could cause Eikenella to be in a wound. Is that correct?
Correct. This was not a primary Eikenella infection. The Eikenella was there. I agree with that. But this was primarily a group A strep infection, and the Eikenella was just what we call a co-pathogen.
Okay. In your opinion, was Dr. McDonough wrong about the Eikenella infection?
Absolutely.
And doctor, to you, is this a matter of opinion?
I mean, his where he was wrong was actually, I mean, he was factually wrong. So he called group A strep, he called it a staph aureus. He was wrong in saying that it was never in the saliva. He was wrong in saying that it's very rare when, again, up in some literature has shown up to like 30% of people at some point will have Eikenella in their mouth, and it can ebb and flow. And so there was a lot of just factual things that microbiologically were just inaccurate in his testimony.
Was Dr. McDonough wrong when he told the jury that the only way Mr. Jones could have gotten Eikenella in his hand was by punching someone in the mouth?
Absolutely wrong.
And that's a matter of objective science, sir?
Absolutely.
Now, this gets super in the weeds, so I won't belabor it, but here's the gist. The fact that Rhoda had hepatitis B had come up before, so that part was considered old Brady, meaning it had already been raised and dismissed as probably not enough to change a jury's verdict. But at the 2022 hearing, Dr. Burdett pointed out something new. Elwood has never tested positive for Hep B, and that actually undermines the state's theory about what happened in that hotel room. The state claims that Elwood got Eikenella in his hand from punching Rhoda in the mouth, but Burdett argued that if that had happened, he would have almost certainly contracted Hep B as well. And yet, decades later, Elwood still doesn't have it. I mean, Hep B can take years to show symptoms, but not 30. That's why Elwood's lawyers couldn't fully argue that Brady point until now. Separately, Judge Cross wrote that based on Dr. Burdett's testimony, a modern jury would hear, quote, substantially different expert testimony and conclusions casting doubt on the validity of the state expert's opinions, end quote. So Cross put her concerns with Elwood's conviction into two buckets, Brady and Petro. The Hep B stuff fell in both, kind of a 1-2 punch, if you will. When prosecutors filed a motion asking the First District for permission to appeal, they only addressed one of those buckets, only Brady. They didn't mention the Petro stuff at all. So the First District denied the request. The appellate response states, quote, even if we agreed with the grounds presented in the state's motion, the new trial order would still stand and the appeal would be futile, end quote. So prosecutors appealed the First District's decision to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed to hear the arguments. It's hard to believe this kind of nuance isn't depicted in the movies, right? When everyone filled the ornate courtroom February 13th, it had been just over 2 years since Jones had been released from prison. He'd been granted permission to leave Hamilton County, where he's living with his sister while awaiting a new trial, to attend the high court arguments. It was kind of an electric atmosphere in a nerdy, wonky sort of way. I met people I had interviewed for Accuse, but whom I'd never actually seen.
So, nice to meet you in
person. Nice to meet you in person, yeah.
This will be interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to get settled.
At the prosecution table was Hamilton County Assistant Prosecutor Phil Cummings, who handled the August 2022 hearing, as well as Train Robinson of the Ohio Attorney General's Office. Elwood's whole defense team was on hand, but the one who spoke to the High Court was David Hine in his first Supreme Court appearance. As soon as he began speaking, it became clear he would have to work hard to make sure his message got through. When lawyers argue before state Supreme Courts, it's not like opening or closing statements in county courthouses. These are timed appearances, Both sides get X number of minutes to try to persuade the justices to see things their way. The time limit means they can't go hog wild. Rather, they present carefully crafted presentations to serve as supplementation to the filings they've already submitted in writing. Those presentations can be, and often are, interrupted by the justices, who might pepper the lawyers with questions. Lawyers with stage fright, or ones who don't think quickly on their feet, can find themselves floundering a bit. The state began with giving Train Robinson of the Ohio Attorney General's office 7 minutes. This was noteworthy because Robinson's inclusion in the arguments highlighted that Ohio AG David Yost had filed an amicus brief in support of Hamilton County prosecutors. A side note, Yost at the time had been planning a run for governor against Trump-endorsed Vivek Ramaswamy, but Yost has since dropped out, leaving Ramaswamy the frontrunner. But sure, keep telling me to keep politics out of true crime. Anyway, Robinson said,
"Let me begin with why prejudice was outside of the range of legally permissible choices, because I think that's really what drove the First District's analysis. Now, if you look at the text of Rule 5C, it just calls for the state to show some probability that the error claimed did in fact occur, not a prejudicial error or a reversible error or an error that affects a substantial right, just an error simpliciter. Now, contrast that with Criminal Rule 52, Civil Rule 61. We're not talking about prejudicial errors here, just the presence of an error. Whether it's a reversible error is a question for the merits stage."
Again, this is why courtroom dramas depict very little of what actually occurs in courtrooms. It's heady, dense, boring stuff. In short, he argued that the First District should have allowed the appeal. Maybe it would have failed, but prosecutors should have been allowed a shot. Then it was Cummings' turn to continue arguing for the state. He spoke for 5 minutes and spoke a bit more plainly.
"I think that it's important to note that this is a capital defendant that's been on death row for decades. His conviction has been reviewed by state courts, by federal courts. It's been repeatedly affirmed. His appeals have been unsuccessful over and over and over again. And here, 30 years later, he is granted a new trial based on double hearsay."
He continued,
"The public interest and the general interest in this case is off the charts. It's undeniable. And for the Court of Appeals to stubbornly decide not to review this case on a fabricated standard that doesn't reflect the law, it should be reversible. And it is reversible, and the state asked this court to do that."
But not only that, Cummings said there was another option.
"And we asked this court to reverse, and if not just reverse outright, the trial court's grant of a new trial, at minimum, send it back to the Court of Appeals with instructions to let the state make its arguments."
That first option, he kind of snuck in there, saying, hey, y'all could just reverse the new trial order completely, would obviously be devastating to Jones and his attorneys. The state saved a smidgen of time of their allotted 15 minutes total for a rebuttal. David Hine, Elwood's lawyer, was up next. After obligatory pleasantries, he barely got started before a justice interrupted him to lob questions.
"The First District Court of Appeals did not abuse its discretion by denying the state's motion for leave to appeal and declining to take an appeal that would have necessarily rendered an advisory opinion."
Did the First District follow the rule?
"Absolutely, Your Honor."
"Well, the rule says the motion shall be accompanied by affidavits, parts of the record upon which the movement relies, to show the probability that the errors claimed did in fact occur. It doesn't say anything about whether..."
The interruptions required Hine to think fast. Again, there's a lot of legalese in this, but the general gist is the state said the trial court, that is, Judge Cross, erred when she ordered a new trial, and Rule 5C directs the prosecutor, when filing a motion to leave, to, quote, "show the probability that the errors claimed did in fact occur," end quote. Robinson and Cummings said the First District should only have assessed whether the prosecutor showed the probability of errors, But they say the First District actually went further than that and assessed the merits of the prosecutor's arguments. They say that was wrong and reversible. David Hines said, no, that was fine. It's up to the First District to decide what appeals it will and won't take. And the only time the Supreme Court has weighed in on those decisions is when an appellate court has been accused of being arbitrary or capricious.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's important to understand that what the First District decided is that the state did not appeal all independent bases for the trial court's decision and left undisturbed the trial court's relief. The trial court granted Mr. Jones a new trial for two reasons, one, Brady evidence, and two, Petro evidence. The state did not appeal one of those. And so what the First District found was that even if we agreed with you, even if let's assume that you had established an absolute certainty that these errors occurred, it wouldn't matter. That's not harmless error. I mean, that's a jurisdictional issue. This court stated in 1972 in State X Rel Park Investment Company versus the Board of Tax Appeals that the courts of appeals lack constitutional and statutory authority to issue advisory opinions. So, to my mind, what the First District did was not an abuse of discretion.
But this isn't issuing an opinion. This is just a decision whether to allow the appeal to proceed.
And, Your Honor, what the Court of Appeals determined was that allowing the appeal to proceed would have been futile because it could not have resulted in anything other than an improper advisory appeal. The entire appeal would have been beyond the court's jurisdiction. That is a model exercise of the First District's jurisdiction or discretion. They can't take the appeal because the state didn't appeal all independent bases, Your Honor.
And that was it. There was no room for grandstanding or going off script. It was done. After the arguments, Elwood gathered with some supporters in the office of Aaron Barnhart, an assistant federal public defender with the Southern District of Ohio. As she passed out cookies to Elwood's friends, she took a look back over the past 10 years. By then, around 2015, she had worked on the case for several years herself, but she needed state lawyers, not federal, to help with what she thought would be minor issues. So she turned to Cincinnati lawyer Jay Clark, and a few years later to David Hine, who joined the team in 2020. Both Jay and David work pro bono. She explained,
so we, as federal attorneys, can't just go into state court, which is where Elwood's case needed to be once we got this new evidence. And so, well, we were kind of pursuing something else, and we asked Jay to just do a little thing. But then when we got this big new evidence, it became a much bigger thing. So big that we're like, this is really too much to ask Jay. And so we had a former law student who worked at the Voorhees Law Firm. And so we're like, hey, do you think you could get some attorneys from your firm to help us out? And that's how we met Dave. And the next thing you know,
what were you supposed to do? What was your limited task?
The experts.
Yeah, I think I was just asking. I just needed to do a direct exam.
Yeah, could you direct the experts?
Yeah, one expert. That's all he had.
Yeah. And so then, you know, next thing you know, the two of them are doing the whole 3-day hearing and everything else since then for free.
The conclusion of the oral arguments felt a long time coming and more or less celebratory on Elwood's side. But everyone left Columbus that day without any idea how things would pan out. The justices don't rule on the spot. We're still awaiting their decision. Elwood, meanwhile, is still living with his sister. He told me in late April he's anxious, even though former prosecutor Joe Dieters, the guy who called him a
murderous bastard,
recused himself as a Supreme Court justice. Elwood said it's hard not to think Dieters might have some sway that could put the thumb on the scale of the decision, not to mention the stance of the Attorney General's office in the case. And to be clear, whatever ruling does come doesn't mark an end to the saga. If the Supreme Court sends it back to the First District, that most likely means a hearing is scheduled. It must be hell for Rhoda's family, who firmly believe Elwood is guilty. They've declined my request for comment, but here's her son, Valentine, speaking in that video Dieters produced.
The mere fact that he's still even alive after all the appeals and everything else, that I'm not ashamed to say it, that he's still breathing? Seriously? My mother is not here. And this guy is still breathing and still appealing. I'm not saying that him dying is going to be fair. No. But him living is certainly not fair.
Elwood's date of execution initially had been set for September 3rd, 1997. If not for his appeals, he would have been dead decades ago. And if not for the state's appeals, he would have been retried last year. If the High Court does what Cummings requested and overturns Judge Cross's order for a new trial, Elwood's lawyers say they won't give up the fight. Rhoda's family is in limbo, and so is Elwood Jones. It's a place he knows well, but still isn't comfortable in. What If They're Wrong, After the Accusation is a production of Just Us Media and Grab Bag Collab. This episode was reported and hosted by me, Amber Hunt. Amanda Rossman is the producer. Amy Wilson, who edited Accused, is back helping us edit these scripts. Daisy Egan of Grab Bag Collab did a read as well. Theme music is by Andrew Higley, also of Accused theme fame. If you like what you hear and want to hear us keep up this kind of investigative work, please rate and review us and tell all of your Accused-loving friends where to find us. And please consider supporting our subscription-based network at www.patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where you get access to this show early and ad-free, plus several others.